Mr. Shuttlewood, could you tell us how you first became involved in the Warminster mystery?
Yes, quite simply, really. It was just that I was the man on the spot, I suppose, to report the news when it first broke. And although I was secretly laughing at the early witnesses, I just couldn't believe that what they were telling me was true. And yet I had... the fact that it was true was proven to me by a personal experience I had 9 months later, after the first outbreak. It all began on Christmas Day of 1964, which is a long while ago. It's almost 2 years ago now. And first of all, the advent of this thing, as we call it, either individually or collectively, we term it the thing, for want of a better name probably, because I don't think that many Warminster people had heard of flying saucers. When this thing broke on Christmas morning of 1964, the first to be affected were troops, soldiers round here at Nook Camp, and they woke. It was just as though, this was told to me by a sergeant up there, it was just as though chimneys had been wrenched off the main barrack roofs and broken apart and the masonry scattered all over the block. That was the sound effects that they had, accompanied by a high-pitched whining or a droning note. The guard turned out, quite frankly, and they saw nothing at all. A few hours later, this would be about 6:12 a.m., Christmas Day, 1964, Mrs. Marjorie Bye, a housewife, was going to church, early morning service, at Christchurch. And then the sounds, as she put it, descended on her, or the aerial vibrations descended on her. She actually felt there's a bodily contact. She felt as though her neck was being pressed down, and she felt most uncomfortable. She was savagely jerked backward, and she just couldn't fight off these vibrations. Again, nothing seen. Now, that was a shocking experience. And although I've led off by saying that I was secretly laughing, I wasn't laughing outwardly. Obviously, I'd be a fool to do that. But as a newsman of 30 years' experience, and pretty hard-headed, I just couldn't really believe that, in full what she was telling me. But then, of course, the head postmaster of war, Mr. Roger Rump, came along, and he'd experienced a similar sort of thing on the same morning at approximately the same time, except that he was luckily in bed. And he heard the sound as of all his 5,000 piles being uprooted, as he called it, by an unseen giant hand, and then smashed on again. But he heard this high droning note, and he wondered. I mean, it couldn't have been high power cables or anything like that. We've checked all the possible things that it could have been, and in this case, it could not have been anything normal or earthly. Well, then, that was the humble start, or auspicious start in one way, I suppose. But then we got on to sightings of the objects themselves. And we've had over 800 people now have seen most peculiar things, but they all conform, really, to two basic patterns or descriptions. One, the long cigar in the sky. And it's often described as a cigar, sometimes with lighted windows, and the conventional, what we now know to be termed a flying saucer, which apparently the outer part spins, the central dome, which is the uppermost part, does not. And there are four portholes, apparently, on either side of the dome. We've checked on that. But, as I say, I was getting... Now, for example, an army major gave me a good story on the thing line, and he said that his car was stopped at over 40 miles an hour. It was stopped dead by an aerial vibration at Colloway Clump. He again, when he jumped out of the car, could feel this pressure from above, and he described the noise to me as though it was 1,000 high-powered refrigeration plants in action all at the one time. Well, of course, we have no refrigeration units around here. That was ruled out. But we've had an RAF pilot's wife, a matron at a hospital physiotherapist, a vicar, his wife, their family. We've had a naval officer who was on leave at the time at Longleat, who has seen these things. We've had engineers, the usual classes of people, headmasters, an art master, art students at a college around here. We've had people of that caliber have actually seen these things. Now, even so, although they seem to be affecting, visually or audibly, they were affecting the right type of people, very high caliber witness in my book. I was still secretly, inwardly laughing at these people because I just didn't believe that anything from outer space could possibly exist. But I was convinced on September the 28th, which is a Tuesday, at 3:42 p.m., I'll never forget, when I saw this cigar for myself, and I trained a camera on it, the movie camera, I could feel a needling sensation up my left arm, the left side of my face. My eye watered for several weeks afterwards. It was very embarrassing. And I could feel that this thing had power that it was pushing out. Whether it thought that I was manning a machine gun, was trying to, you know, fire away at it, or whether it disliked or didn't want to be photographed, I wouldn't like to say, but I think really there was certainly no radioactivity there. I checked up with the doctor. There was nothing radioactive or harmful about the ray that was being pushed out. But I think it was pushed out really and truly. I think that the main reason was, this is a disbelieving sort of chap. Now, we've got to convince him personally, and they did. There's no doubt about it. And the camera jumped about in my hands. I dropped it, and the film had jumped off the reel before that, I'm sure, because there were only a few inches of film on the thing, and the rest was just blackened out. And I've produced this in evidence. I've been in touch with the Air Ministry, or they've been in touch with me, rather, on an average twice a week since last August. And everything, every sighting that's happened, witnesses' names, addresses, location in sky of the object, direction it's pursuing, any variation in speed, and any variation in colour, and I find that the two are synonymous. If there's a variation in colour, it denotes that there's an alteration in speed. I think we've given them some useful information, and particularly how these craft, all of them, have the capacity, apparently, I say apparently, of changing shape, or they do visually to us. But that could be, of course, that they're travelling at that particular time so fast that the eye just can't follow them. It got a bit more serious in September and October for a period of about 7 weeks. I was getting nightly phone calls here, and I just couldn't weigh them up. I thought these people must be absolute hoaxers, but I didn't think it was a very good, a very nice thing to do, to pull anyone's leg. These things were still happening all about here. As I say, over 800 people have been affected, and I say affected deliberately, because a number of them tell me afterwards that they feel somehow different after having seen these things at close, particularly at close quarters. They do seem to get a moral or a spiritual uplift, and they become, as they term it, better people. You know, they want to be more tolerant. Whether that conveys anything, I wouldn't know. That may be going into the realms of the esoteric or the, you know, arcane. I don't believe in the supernatural. But these calls, harking back to these calls, now these, if they were not hoaxes, could be the most relevant and the most revelationary things that have ever happened, because I was contacted on the phone by three people. Now, they rang from a local phone box. They even gave me the kiosk number. There was no doubting the fact that they were there, because, I mean, the whole family here, you know, would know that they were here. And I had Peter Earle of the News of the World down, who was following up a theme story at the time when the first call broke. And I handed the receiver to him, and he listened. Now, as you know, if you get a local call, you get the four pennies dropping. But there were no pennies dropping at all, and all that I could hear was a distinct crackling noise as of electricity, and this accompanied the voices always that came through to me. There were three people, and they claimed that they came from a planet, or a cantel, as they termed it, called Anstria, and I made them spell it out, A-E-N-S-T-R-I-A. The female queen, the commander of the planet Anstria, or the cantel Anstria, was named Telerison, and I made her spell that out. The chap who first came to me on their behalf was called Kaelsan, C-A-E-L-L-S-A-N, and he told me that phonetically it wouldn't matter if I spelled it with a K to begin with. But what they told me, the third person, was a chap called Celeric, S-E-L-L-R-I-K, who was the English interpreter of the planet. Kelson was the spacecraft commander, and Trellison was the female queen. Now, they told me, this sounded outrageous to me, but among the little incidental and things and trivia that they told me to begin with, as though trying to persuade me, well, you must listen, you know, here is what sort of people we are, and this is what we're here for. Leading up to that, they told me that, or Trellison, for example, said that she was 758 years old in our Earth terms. Their conception of time, I would imagine, is different from ours, but in our Earth terms, she was 758 years old. Kiel San and Celeric and Trelisar, come to that, all warned me that this Earth should know certain information. And I took this down painstakingly in shorthand, and I wrote my notes up for my book. But I wrote them up. I didn't want to use them because I was thinking all the time, am I being hoaxed? Well, now, the wife was rather nervous at all these calls coming through. Although these voices were very musical, beautiful voices, there was this electric crackling, and they didn't term me dear Shuttlewood or Shuttlewood, my friend. It was always Shuttlewood. But when they referred to one another, it was our beloved Trelisson, our beloved Kelsan, our beloved Celeric. Well, these calls went on for 7 weeks. And in about the third week, the wife said, look, I'm getting fed up with this. I'm really nervous about these people. She was convinced that these calls were genuine, I think. But she was a little bit worried as to what type of people they were. Well, I told her very little, but I did agree that the next time they came through, we would get onto the police on another phone, get them to go to this call box and apprehend whoever was in there, so that if it was a hoaxer, all well and good, we'd know. If it wasn't, well, then we didn't know what would happen. But we had this signal, you see, and I was giving her the signal as she came downstairs from putting the baby up to bed one night, about the third week of these calls, and she was going to fly to the phone, to have her father's phone, which is in another house down the road. But as soon as I gave a signal, and I'd said nothing at all about this phone call, the voice on the other end, which I think was Kelsan at that time, warned me immediately. He could read my mind, I've no doubt about that. He monitored my thoughts, because he said immediately, please do not try and apprehend us. It will be the worst for you, and we have nothing but love and compassion for your people, but we are here for specific purposes. But for heaven's sake, do not try and apprehend us. We will have to harm you if you do. No one can apprehend us. And that struck me as most peculiar. Several other things were beyond the pale of sheer coincidence, because, for example, on the first night that they rang, it was a Saturday, September the 10th, on September the 9th, or was it 11th? Well, no, it wouldn't be 7th, but anyway, our story came out in the Mirror in September, together with young Faulkner's picture, which is a genuine picture of the thing. On the next day, in the Mirror, a false picture appeared, a hoax picture that had been made up, you know. And this was on that particular night that the Kelsan rang through. And, of course, I immediately said, sort of stringing him along and laughing, you know, in a laughing fashion, I said, well, what did you think of our picture in the Mirror yesterday? And he said, by our standards, very poor, palpably poor, but by your standards, good, it is of our machine. And, or one of our craft, one of our spacecraft. And then I said, well, what did you think of the picture in the Mirror today? And this was 2 days, mark you, before it was acknowledged to be a hoax picture. And immediately he said, it is too serious to laugh at, really, although we have the sense of humor as you have, as you people have. But it is a fake, fake, fake. A great shame. And that was 2 days before. Well, a lot of things of that nature crept into the conversations, and it was as though not only could he monitor my thoughts, I couldn't monitor his, but he could certainly follow my trend of thought. Very, very rarely did I have to ask them, any of them, a question. As soon as the question was in my mind and being framed, they'd answer immediately. So it was very uncanny. Well, anyway, these calls went on for 7 weeks, and then I think that these people sensed. I wasn't still fully convinced, obviously. I've got to keep my feet well on the ground as a journalist. And to tell the people the truth, I don't care a hang about editors. That doesn't worry me what they want. I think it's the people that count most. But the messages that they gave me, these three, they would always finish off their telephone conversations each night with this warning or advice. Remember that the light from the suns, in the plural, the light from the suns shines upon us all. And their great fear, I look upon it as a fear, was not so much that they're filled with brotherly love for us and they want to save us, but I think that they're also, it's a matter of self-preservation to them, because if what they were telling me was correct, we could really, by our own stupid nuclear experimentation and precipitate actions, if you like, on the part of well-meaning scientists but misled scientists, If we committed some stupid mistake with the application of nuclear energy, we could ignite the whole of our Earth's envelope, or our Plantel's envelope, Cantel's envelope, as they would say, these people. In turn, as our scientists do not appreciate how perilously thin the atmosphere is around other galaxies, in addition to how perilously thin it is even between our planets in this solar system, we could destroy our own creative system on this Earth. We could destroy or disrupt the creative system as laid down by what they call the great spirit of universal truth, which is apparently God. Yeah, that's their terminology. We could destroy the whole of our solar system, or destroy its creative system. We would blast our sun out of the sky. We could also then, by repercussions through space, we could knock their galaxies out of the sky. And that's their great fear. I'm certain of that, if what they're telling me is correct. And also, they gave me pointers to this effect, that we are already, what we have done so far, is already weakening a protective belt around this Earth. It's gouging holes in that belt, and they have to remedy that for us, and for their own sakes as well. Now, I was getting messages of that type, and everyone, all of these three people, we'll call them people for now, assuming they weren't hoaxers, were telling me how anxious they are to come onto Earth, to land without fear of being, you know, shot at, without fear of being scorned too much, more than they have been already. When the time is right, they want to land, and they can help our medical people and our scientists in the correct application of both medical pursuits and scientific pursuits. They know no disease. They've conquered disease thousands of years ago, so therefore they could help all this world's people as far as cancer and the killing diseases go. They can also tell us what we can do in the right sense. We're now in an ultimate stage of evolution, the nuclear age, they tell us. That's why they're concerned, because it's so fatally easy, having got to that stage, to make a precipitate action or to mix wrong elements or put wrong additives to the compound. And therefore, we would blow ourselves up and that would be it. And of course, they fear that, I'm sure, if their messages are correct. Well, now, as I say, up till that time, I was laughing inwardly a little bit, until I was speaking to some scientists and medical people about this, and it's surprising how seriously a number of them took this. And I could tell that scientists did know, as these people have warned us, that there are only three basic branches of science, and I'm non-scientific, you know. There's a material or a physical science. There's a spiritual science, there's a social science. Now, for the past half century, this is what I've been told by all of these three people at different times, our material and physical science, which is gratifying our concrete needs, you know, it's materialism, motor cars, television sets, what have you, transport even, the superstructure of that science is dwarfing the other two sciences, which are spiritual and social. We're losing sight of spiritual and social sciences, which are creative. We don't know how to use their creations, so that the superstructure of the material science is in danger now of collapsing on top of the other two. And if that happens, well, we've finished as a world. And they know that, so I think that there's a little something here that's a little bit religious. They're here, they tell me. They're not the only planet engaged in this operation, but it is an operation, and apparently it's by divine guidance that they're here. They're not allowed under universal law to actually come down among us and tell us exactly what's wrong, but they have to give pointers, and they allege that they have in fact contacted the governments of all the leading nations on this Earth, that's the nuclear powers obviously, and that these governments know who they are, they know what their primary purposes and aims are in coming to Earth, and I've quoted these certain dates on which certain things are alleged to have happened around here, and definitely nothing to do with the military, no accidents reported or anything like that from the police. So far as I'm concerned, and I'm convinced now, having watched them every night for the past 9 months, these things, on clear nights, they've been, ever since February the 25th, on Cradle Hill, we've seen them above us, hovering, as though saying, well, here we are, you know? And I've no doubt in my mind now that these are interplanetary or extraterrestrial or whatever you want to call them. They're certainly not of this Earth. So that therefore, looking back, I'm convinced now that the calls I received were genuine, particularly when I've witnessed landings myself up on that hill. That sounds incredible, but there are certain things I couldn't tell people at the moment. They would just laugh. But I think my book will pave the way. It's given faithfully, I think. As a reporter, a trained observer should write it up. It's given the whole facts of what has happened around here, and they have been facts. There's been no confusion in people's minds about military rockets or flares or satellites coming over. Now, for example, I'll give you one little example here. We've had these things coming into the sky. We've timed them, and they come straight into you. It's like a curtain of light. It's over your head from the horizon, but in a straight line, not as a satellite comes up over the horizon. It's above your head in 18 seconds. Now, that's 36 seconds, assuming it went on instead of hovering. Absolutely noiseless. It hovers for up to an hour. It can cross the whole horizon, therefore, in less than 40 seconds. We'll put it at that. A satellite, which is traveling at 17,500 miles an hour, takes between 10 and... Well, we've worked it out, between 10 and 14, I would say, minutes, to cross the same horizon. That's doing that speed. What speed are these things doing, even assuming they're no more than 40 or 50 miles up? And although that's the norm, I think, we're pretty certain. We've gone into it very deeply recently because we've had it forced onto us. There's a little observation team of three on that hill every clear night. An ex-RAF crewman, an airborne fighter, Bob Strong, who's seen over 340 of these things since February the 25th this year. There's Mrs. Sybil Champion, a housewife, who's intensely interested in this, as indeed I am. I lead the little team, but I don't consider that I'm a leader. I don't consider that I'm an expert in this subject. But it's been forced upon me to do something because so many people have been down here, hundreds from all over the world, and they say, well, look, you're at the center of this. You've taken all the evidence on these things. Obviously, you're the right man in the right place at the right time. I rather like that, but it could have been anyone. You know, it could have been Jack Jones, Joe Soap, or anyone. You know what I mean? I'm not out for publicity myself, but I felt that it's my bounden duty to chronicle as faithfully as I can what's happened here, and I want to crack open the whole enigma to get really at the bottom of this so that we have visual proof. With magistrates, if you like, the Chief Inspector of Police, the Brigadier at the School of Infantry, high military people, civilian people. I want them all there when these people do come down, and I want them to appear, if possible, in the photographs that we take of them on the ground. And I take a notebook and pencil every night up there in case this does happen, so that I can be there to interview them. But I think it's a phenomenal thing. Of course it is. It's a fantastic thing. But there's so much evidence generating from all parts of the world, or emanating from all parts of the world, that this is... Warminster is not unique insofar as these things go. You know, these sources, whatever you like to call them. I don't like the term sources. I prefer the term thing, although that may sound a little bit derogatory. It's not meant to be. But we're seeing them at such close range on some nights that we're convinced now that they will land shortly and tell us everything. We're convinced. Otherwise we'd be fools, wouldn't we, to go up there every night, every clear night for about 8 or 9 months now. And of course, we're learning things all the time. And I hope the book does give a pointer to people, as long as they have open minds. Now here's another peculiar factor. I put a letter into our local journal. I'm the feature editor and chief reporter, and I put into that letter a warm invitation to anyone with an open mind in Warminster to come up and join our team for one night when it's clear. Any night that they like, they can come and join our team. I had two replies, that's all, out of a town and district of 11,000 people. And yet word of what we are seeing got out to America and Australia. We've had Australians up there, we've had American headmasters, people of that nature have flown all the way by jet, 3,000 or 4,000 miles from West Orange in New Jersey, for example. Richard George, a headmaster of a school there, he came all the way from America just on spec, purely on blind faith that he would see the Warminster thing, and he was the first one to observe it from the hill, and it hovered. Now, he went back, and he was thrilled to bits. And yet, you see, you have that the whole world is interested, but the people of Warminster, and I'm not running them down, because there are a lot of brave and fearless people who have come forward, braving ridicule, to tell me what they've seen. I'm not running the whole of Warminster down, but I think that it's a very apathetic town. Certainly, so far as the thing is concerned. If only they had open enough minds to come up, but they will laugh at it all, the majority of people, even now, I'd say that 70% of people in Warminster admit that the thing is there. Well, 90% would, but 70% would still persist. Even after seeing it, they would say, well, it must be something secret, on the secret list. And when you get that attitude, I mean, you can't do anything. We take astro compasses up there, theodolites, compasses, we take bearings, we take measurements as far as we can. We've got a 3-inch telescope, a good camera now. We've just forked out 90 quid for a good camera with a telephoto lens in an effort to get more detail, you know, to satisfy officialdom, to satisfy everyone, really. But you still get that attitude that, we'll grant that we're getting something peculiar here, but we think it's something on the secret list. And that rather annoys me in a quiet way. I don't show feeling. I think we should all be tolerant. If there's one thing that these things teach you, I think it's love and tolerance. I certainly had a change of attitude, I think, or of character even, I think, in one way, since being in contact with these things.
Have the aliens told us anything about life on planets in this solar system?
They've told, so far as, well, these, of course, you must understand, are not of our, they're not in our solar system. The Anstrians, they told me that to begin with, that they are not. Venus and Mars, for example, which definitely are peopled, according to them. Venus and Mars, of course, go under different names to them, so that Venus and Mars would convey nothing to, you know, that's not their terminology. I mean, they call an Earth, or a planet, if you like, their term for it, as I stressed, is Cantel, C-A-N-T-E-L. But there are several things I have learned, and that is, reincarnation is definite. Whether religious people like to accept it or not, they tell me that reincarnation is a definite fact. So that if you read your Bible, it still doesn't conflict, that you die and you're born again, you reawaken, your soul lives on, and that is the essence of it. But it doesn't mean to say that you go into another sphere, into a heaven. You're born here, where you're born originally, you keep being reincarnated until you've reached the perfection required before you go and join these people in another planet. And there, the God says, doesn't he, that in my house are many mansions. Well, obviously, that is the conception of heaven if you're religious. And I'm not awfully religious, you know. And yet, I can only get that on my consciousness all the time, is that this is a great spiritual force that's moving down in our atmosphere. I get that. I'm not the only one to get that impression. Bob Strong, I think you'll find, or anyone who's studied this thing at close quarters and in any detail and for any length of time, you gradually become aware that there's something big and profound and could be extremely helpful and beneficial to mankind in this operation that the planets are doing. You asked me about other planets. It's factual, according to these people, that Mars and Venus, I know for a fact, those two are peopled.
Intelligent people.
Absolutely like us. Absolutely as we are. Except that the people with whom I dealt are even more advanced. They're even more advanced. I'm convinced of that because we've had a number of cases here of people having seen someone who and talked to them, and then the person has disappeared. So I think that these people have not only gained an extra sense, you know, they have six senses as opposed to our five, they have an extra dimension, they've mastered the fourth dimension. They can alter, if you like, the frequency, you know, of their atomic particles. We're all made up of atomic particles, after all. They can lower and raise at will the frequencies of the atomic particles of which flesh is composed, flesh and bone. And I think that they can render themselves invisible to sight. They would appear to be invisible and then become visible when they want to. And I think that they can also erect a force barrier, not only around their craft, to cushion it against friction when travelling at high speeds. I think they have their own personal barrier, which they can erect also, because we've heard of various cases. We've had various cases of people going along at night in a car. They've seen someone lying in a road. They've gone over. Bang, front wheels over. Bang. The rear wheels over. They've run back in great alarm, thinking, oh, God, I must have killed him or seriously injured him. Run back, nowhere near at all. No bloodstains. That's happened. So it sounds fantastic, but I think that for the world, by next May, there's a quiet little prophecy here, by next May of 1967, I think that this world will have to be convinced that these people are here.
Will they come down?
Well, I can't tell you that. Just take that as a quiet prophecy. Mrs. Annabel Plowman, who's the secretary of the Warminster and District Trades Council. Her husband is chairman of the Agricultural Workers Union for the district. They've both seen these people, obviously, and she particularly. Her experience was quite hair-raising. She was coming back at about 5:20 past 12, or 0025, as the military would say, you know. Quite dark, coming back across a skew bridge at Heytesbury, which is only about 2 miles from us. And she experienced something which really shook every one of us at the time when we heard about this. As I say, I checked up with police and military afterwards. Definitely nothing to do with military or the police. No military exercises, no underground exercise that night at this hour. She came along. Her car, when she got to the approach to the skew bridge, she could see from the corner of her eye on the road ahead. The side of the road, there's a railway embankment, and on that embankment she could see an orange ball of light. Quite stationary. As she got over the skew bridge, her engine began to pack up. She described her lighting, for example, as like a candle in the wind. She more or less drew to a stop. Quite involuntarily, but I mean, she still got a foot well down and she was in the right gear. But the force of this thing, the radiance, you know, the force that it was putting out was stopping her car. There's no other reason for that. We've had about 9 cases up on the Westbury Road here of the same nature. Cars, scooters, lorries, all sorts of things have stopped up there. And wristwatches stop as well, and compasses go all haywire, you know, and these things are about.
Is that where the army camp is, just at the bottom of the hill? We went there today. There's an army camp down the bottom.
Oh, no. This is on the civilian road out of Warminster, on the Westbury Road. No, it's a good 4 miles from the firing area, the safe firing area of the military, or even the operational area of the military is a good 2 miles from there. This is Colloway Clump on the Westbury Road. We've had some peculiar experiences there, but to get back to this one particular one, which is just illustrative of several, I promise you that. I've given you the names, we've got nothing to hide. Her car was virtually stopped. Well, the funny thing was that when this ball just slithered into the road in front of her, and then she could tell it was whirling round at a furious pace, and then it set off at an angle of about 90 degrees, you know, it just shot straight up at a tangent, and as soon as it went away, her car purred into life again. But this peculiar thing, she noticed a spherical object. You could tell it was round, and that's all. It was very dark. But by the radiance of the other thing on the opposite side of the road, she could tell that there was one of these things parked without a light. There was no light on it at all. There's no light. As she got closer to this, she still couldn't see because of the radiance, you know. She could tell that she couldn't really pick out any detail because of the radiance of the thing which was going away. But she could tell it was a similar type of thing. As she got past there, there were two figures in the road. And these two figures obviously had no idea of road safety, you know, children have in cycling professions. They had no idea at all of safe roadworthiness because they were standing bang in the middle of the road. One, a little bit more on her side, you know, on her left-hand side than the other. The other chap was well out into the middle, and they were trying to stop her. They were waving their arms about, and they were definitely trying to stop her. Well, you can imagine the effect on a young girl, even a responsible girl, and she's a confidential clerk at a big military camp round here, in addition to being trade union secretary for the town and district. She obviously had the wind up, you know, and she had to go onto her wrong side of the road, well onto the wrong side of the road, to get past them. And she described them in detail, which is confirmed and corroborated by at least 7 other people. And they all have the same description, that they have... They're in dark clothing. It could be a chocolate brown or a dark grey. People are not certain of the colouring because these things have happened at night. They've seen their craft go into and out of water. They've seen these people standing by their craft. They've even seen the people without their craft, apparently. But they all wear the same garb, which is a single one-piece, close-fitting, woolen type of uniform, I'd say, or clothing, a balaclava-type helmet, which normally shows just their forehead, the side of their cheekbones, and comes to a point near the chin. In some cases, they have not seen any mouth there because it's covered the mouth. Very wide faces, very broad shoulders, tapering limbs, very thin legs, but high, broad foreheads. And when the eyes have been seen, they've been what has been described to me as a thing of great compelling power and great beauty, as though there's some perhaps hypnotic, mildly hypnotic influence about the eyes. There are things I could tell you about what I've seen that I would rather not, if you don't mind. You know, as I'll keep it to the facts of my witnesses. But I think that in the end, people will know what I'm trying to get at in that book. You know, I think that they will really appreciate that these people are real, their craft are real, they're much more highly evolved than we are, but although they may be closer to God than we are, if you want to be religious, they are good. In the majority of them are.